Got a quorum here. Thanks for joining me. My name's Chris Hallam. I'm Senior Product Manager for Windows Client Security. So that's anything on the desktop, anything in the client that has to do with securing it locally is something that falls in my wheelhouse. Security, of course, is a much larger topic, right? We have things on the server side and Azure. Those kind of fall into the server team, so I'm not an Azure security expert. But when it comes to client, I think I can answer most of your questions. And so today we're going to talk about what we think is the end of password and credential theft. We have a great new innovative solution. Just before I get into it, though, how many of you attended the overview session yesterday? Okay. So for those of you who attended yesterday, you're going to see a lot of familiar slides. This deck here is a double click, so you're going to see a lot of new content. It might be about 50% new. So just be aware that there is some redundancy because this is just the drill down on some of the content we talked about yesterday. But I think you'll find that there's a lot of great new info for you here. And so without further ado, let's go ahead and dive in and kind of set the context of why we made the investments that we've made in Windows 10. And so as you know, of course, the world is changing and there's all these world of opportunities. Of course, that is true every day and whatnot. But mobility is something that I'm particularly interested in when it comes to security. And so mobility is something that everybody's been talking about. And in most people's minds, it means a mobile phone or a tablet that has very limited access to resources. Those resources are typically sitting inside some sort of container. So if I have access to my email, as an example, it's sitting inside of a good container and a good email client. So as an example, there could be many other options like AirWatch containers or Samsung Knox, and there's a lot of other ways that people interact on mobile with corporate content, but it doesn't feel very familiar. It's limited compared to what we experience on the PC, not just in the way that we access the content and use it, but also in how much content we can get access to. And so our vision at Microsoft for mobility is that experience should be as rich as it is on the PC. And while the input devices that we have available on a PC versus a phone are very different, one's all about touch, the other is maybe touch plus keyboard and mouse, I should never be limited in my ability to do more or do what I do on a PC on a phone. And so if you're familiar with universal apps as an example, you'll see that an app that runs on the desktop has the same functionality on Windows Phone. So our vision for mobility is robust and richer than I think what we see in the marketplace today, and for that reason, we need high-end security, particularly in identity, to enable you to feel confident when you take mobility to the next level. And so the challenge, though, with mobility, not just on the information worker side of things, in the app side of things, is that the security landscape has changed. And so a lot of people have some trepidation or are worried about kind of unleashing mobile to be as rich as what they're doing on their desktops. And so with Windows 10, of course, we want to change that by delivering functionalities that give you the same level of confidence. And so why do we need that? Why do we need these extra security features on mobile and even on the desktop? Well, it's because we're no longer dealing with evolution of cyber threats. We're actually dealing with a revolution of cyber threats. And so if we think about what we've experienced in the last 10 years, if we averaged it out, I think what a lot of us would say is the attacks got a little bit worse every year. The attackers made a little bit more money and they became a little bit more sophisticated year on year. But I think in the last couple of years, we're no longer at the bottom of the hockey stick. We're actually moving very quickly up the hockey stick, meaning the attacks are getting dramatically more successful, dramatically more impactful, and costing a lot of money for certain organizations. In fact, not only that, it's actually costing people their jobs, as we'll talk about very briefly. There's a CEO who's no longer running a company because possibly he didn't listen to some of his advice from a security team, and they just were not prepared for the threat that took down their POS system. But we'll get to that later on. So we really are in the middle of a revolution, and so organizations on the high end, on the low end, even those on the high end, right? You'd think that a company like Lockheed Martin or Airbus, these big, large companies with large budgets to deal with the security risks they're dealing with, have the ability to defend themselves against these modern threats. But the reality is really what they have is they have defense in depth to the nth degree, right? We use defense in depth almost too much. It's still a tactic we need to continue on, but what we really need is we need architectural changes to our devices and our systems to eliminate the risk factors altogether. I don't want just another defense that makes it harder for an attack to be successful. I want an architectural change that makes an attack maybe impossible, or diminishes it to the point where it's no longer economically viable or technically viable. So we want architectural solutions, not just another layer of perimeter defense making it harder. So you're struggling with the threats, and then here's a long list of names of people who struggle. Some of them have been struggled multiple times. Of course, we struggle every day, but sometimes we struggle in the news less frequently. J.P. Morgan, many of you know them. They were in the news a couple years ago with a pretty significant attack. Well, just a couple weeks ago, again, another serious network infiltration occurred, and some very sensitive information was taken out of that organization. Now, luckily, the bank accounts and whatnot, they've said that those accounts were secure, but the fact that they were able to get in and exfiltrate data, very likely from their research department, represented a pretty big financial liability or a problem for them. So J.P. Morgan in the news recently. Lockheed is a great example. Lockheed, in response to Flame, if you remember Flame a number of years ago, Lockheed said that to deal with these type of modern threats, we are spending as much money defending our supply chain and our contractors and our vendors and all these people who work with us but not for us. They're spending just as much protecting them as they are protecting their own infrastructure. So they spend 2x, half to protect themselves and half to protect everybody else that they work with. So in other words, if you're building nuts and bolts for the F-35, you are being actively targeted right now, and Lockheed is defending you to the extent that it can. And so we could go on and on in this list and talk about each one. I guess my favorite, of course, is the Bushehr nuclear reactor example. That's the place where Stuxnet, we learned about that there. And of course, that's an air gap network, right? So how did malware get in there? We all know somebody carried that in probably. But anyway, the point is that we're not as safe as we'd like to be, and we don't have the systems we need to deal with, I think, the problem set. So when we look at how attackers are getting in, there's lots of different ways. I think the old way of thinking is that there's a vulnerability in a server sitting on the edge of our network, and somebody exploits that, and they get inside. And that's an attack that probably still happens today. But I think what we're seeing is a lot more activity going after endpoints directly. This has been not new necessarily, but I think it's more successful lately because of an attack we'll talk about in a moment. But typically they're going after users, spear phishing or whale phishing, individual targets, trying to get them to give their credentials to a fake website, as an example, through some sort of phishing attack. And once they get maybe that user's credentials and maybe have access to their device, maybe if they can get it physically, they can use attacks like pass the hash or pass the ticket to traverse across the network undetected. So I can get your identity, but not your username and password. I actually have your access is really what I have. And I can use your access tokens to walk around the network with impunity and very likely even undetected. So pass the hash is an example of an attack that we're very focused on. We'll talk about that a little later on. But the point that I'm trying to make on this slide is we really believe that identity is one of the key entry points into getting into organizations. And so we need a solution. And so with Windows 10, we're going to deliver one. And so Windows 10 itself is designed to protect us in a number of ways. One is identity, which we're here to talk about. Another is related to information protection and also threat resistance. And so we will do a one-hour session tomorrow. I think it's tomorrow morning around 10 or so about enterprise data protection, which is a DLP capability that's brand new, and I'll be presenting that there. So if you're interested in that topic, I encourage you to come. But for this session, we're going to cover identity, and we're not really covering threat resistance, which malware resistance and these things. At TechEd this year, we're doing it to a limited degree in our overview session because our malware resistance story is something we're actually going to disclose probably next year. There's a lot of work and planning still going on, and we're trying to assess how effective it will be before we make big statements about what's getting delivered. But let's drill into secure identity, and this is the story, right? We are going to usher in the end of passwords. And so I want to be really clear about why I use the word usher, right? People always talk about the end of passwords, and then they never tend to go away, right? And there's no solution that I can just give you. You turn on a switch, and all the passwords on the web, all the passwords on-prem, all the passwords in your proprietary software or your ISV software, that they just go away, right? That's just not possible because we technically can't do it. But what we can do is for your network and your Windows domain, or your Azure Active Directory domain, or your Microsoft accounts, if we're talking about consumers, With this release, we can move you away from passwords very, very quickly, almost like turning on a switch. But where we can't turn on the switch is on the web. You know, what about Amazon.com? What about all these other websites that have network or password infrastructure? How do we change that? Well, that's going to take some time, and we'll talk a little bit about how that's going to work during this presentation. But when it comes to your network, your Azure Active Directory, you're going to find this is very easy to deliver, and it's a two-factor option. So why are passwords so bad? Well, here's evidence of why they're so bad. There's an article that came out, it's almost a couple months now, where one organization claims, I'm not sure if it's true, but they self-reported that 1.2 billion username and password combinations were sitting in their hands. Okay, and there's only 1.8 billion people online. So if we do the math, that means that, you know, over half of our the users here have a password in the hands of this group. Now, that statistic you need to think about clearly because we all have multiple accounts, and maybe the average account per person is 10. I don't know what it is, but so it's probably not technically 50%. But the likelihood is very high, and that's a very large number, and it should definitely strike fear in you. I think the thing that's maybe more scary is the number on the right, though, on your right, which is 420,000 websites were breached to get this data. So that tells you what a lovely target these websites that do e-commerce are, right? And here's what makes it even more interesting. 75% of you in this audience statistically, although maybe not this group because you are interested in security, but 75% of users all up use the same password on every website. So if you get a username and password combination, you can probably access that user's account. They probably have a Facebook account. They probably have a Twitter account. So you can probably access a lot of things, even if you breach the flower shop website, right, that's insignificant and fairly likely unprotected. So these attackers are going after not just eBay, not just, you know, big Amazon websites, these types of things. They're going after anything that might have a username and password store because it gives you everything you need. So here's another one, and this gets back to the CEO story I talked about, which is Target. So many of you are familiar with this story. This story is about POS systems that were infiltrated, malware was deployed to it, and the credit card data was ripped off and put on the internet. So if you went out and you went on the Tor network, you could find websites that were making these credit cards were basically for sale anywhere from pennies to $100 per credit card. So it could be anywhere depending on the credit card. I have no idea how they price these things. But this was obviously a very valuable thing. We're talking about 10 million credit cards, some of which were worth $100 on the black market each. So it's very valuable. Now, what you probably knew that part of the story, but what maybe some of you did not know is how did they break into that network? Well, they broke into the network because of identity. So Target has a great security team, but they had a gap in their security protocol. What they were doing is they were giving username and passwords to third parties who serviced, in this case, their air conditioning systems. So the organization that did temperature control inside their retail stores had a username and password. They were able to access the network remotely, and they were able to then get inside the network and then deploy malware. Now, I don't think it was the air conditioning company that deployed the malware, but the account itself became compromised and gave somebody access to that network. So it's a perfect example of identity theft in action. And it turns out that according to analysts, that will cost Target over the long term $500 million to $1.2 billion, depending on the analyst that you talk to, because they're having to pay for a lot of the fraud that's related to these credit cards that were stolen. Now, it's not just Target, though. I know this is another American company, but Home Depot is one of the largest hardware and home repair store. These stores are huge. If you haven't been to the U.S. and have seen a Home Depot store, these are giant stores, like maybe eight times as big as this room, just full of wood and nuts and bolts and all the things you would need to build a home or repair a home or renovate it. They were breached just a couple weeks ago with the same type of technique. Maybe not through password theft, but the credit cards were stolen using similar malware. And then we could insert 1,000 other names here, I'm sure. We can talk about Kmart, another U.S. company, Dairy Queen, and we could go on and on and on. So this is happening in a rampant way. And so analysts fairly recently are starting to talk about this. I think that they were aware of the problem, but they weren't really talking about it much. Now they're saying, hey, it's now it's a time of urgency to move away from this. And it really is an elephant in the room for most organizations, right? Most of organizations, including you, I assume, have two-factor authentication solution in your organization. But statistically, most of you are not using it for sign-on to devices. You're only using it for VPN. That's what most people are doing. And why is that? Two-factor authentication is a big pain. It's very expensive, it's cumbersome, it gets in the way of productivity, etc. So you use it in the case where you need it most, which is remote access, because you don't want somebody stealing credentials and logging into your network from a foreign country, right? Which is the big problem we used to face. So Gartner is finally evangelizing it. But now that Kirsten Dunst and a bunch of other Hollywood celebrities had their photos taken from the iCloud, probably not because of a breach in security of the iCloud infrastructure, but probably because of password theft from that group I talked about earlier, I think finally people are going to start waking up, because now it's made the headlines in the consumer space. So now suddenly the media is interested, that's not related to technology, and I think finally we're going to have some change. So let's start getting close to the technology. That's all pitch we've talked about so far. So let's talk about the solution. But before we do that, why are passwords so bad? Because they're single factor, right? That's the first problem. All I only need is that one thing. The other thing that's bad about them is they're shared or shareable. They're shared with the IDP. My IDP knows my password, right? I know my password. And if you can trick me into going to your website and entering in my credentials, then you can get my password too. So in fact, I was talking earlier today, I went into a data center, believe it or not, and there was a I was inside their cage, and there was a piece of paper with a password printed on it, inside it. Now, their theory was like, oh, it's secure. I've got walls outside my building. I got a lock on my data center, and you're in a cage. Only trusted people are in there. Guess what? I have your password, right? So I'm a trustworthy guy, but I don't work for you. I have your password, and that's astounding to me that they operated this way. I can't tell you who it was, for obvious reasons. All right, so let's talk about one scenario where passwords fail us, and this is in the consumer space particularly. We talked about this a little bit, but the weakest link is oftentimes a human, but I think more often on the consumer space, it's actually the websites you use. So if I want to get access to your bank, I can beat my head against the wall and try to brute force my way in your bank account using random passwords or whatever, or breach the security of the infrastructure itself and maybe get it that way, or I can just go to the little flower shop that you bought flowers once from, but had to create an account, and now I've got your username and password, and I can now get to your bank, right? So that's one way. Another way is something that you should be more worried about, because that's really something that affects the consumer space. Active Directory is not really vulnerable to that type of attack, right? Because we encrypt the passwords and they can't be decrypted, et cetera. But what you should be aware of course, is your users are a weak link. They can be phished. Every day at Microsoft, we have new phishing campaigns executed on us, and they try to lure us to websites that look just like our Office 365 website. It looks just the same, has the same imagery, right? And unless you're looking at the URL, and I look at it, but many of my peers who are not maybe as savvy about security maybe don't, they enter in their username and passwords there. So that's one way. But here's another way that maybe some of you don't know about, which is the device itself. There are attacks right now that are still exploitable on all versions of Windows, where if you have physical access to the device and the device is not encrypted, you can decrypt the username and password out of the SAM data store. Right? So there are tools out there in the wild right now. So if you are not encrypting using a full volume encryption solution on your PCs that are laptops or desktops or things even in the data center, you're vulnerable to this type of attack. They will get your username, your domain name, your username, and your password. So if you're not discarding disks in a secure way and that disk has an OS on it, be scared. That thing is vulnerable. And so if somebody's targeting you, they might be able to get that data. So that's another way. So if we're going to go beyond passwords, what do we need? We need something that's two factors. We need to be breach, theft, and phish proof. We want it to give us true single sign-on rather than the half-baked single sign-on that we have today. How many of you have gone to Office 365 and been asked to enter in your username and credentials again after you'd already done it, right? Happens more frequently. Like, we want to fix that, and the solution that we have in mind will do just that. And then maybe one of the most important things There's actually something that's not even on the slide, but the first thing is it has to be as convenient as a password because your users need something simple. They're not technology people like us, but it has to have the security of an enterprise-grade solution like a smart card or something similar to it, right? So those two things usually don't come hand in hand, but our solution has that. So let's get into it. And so I'm going to skip this slide here and just kind of go into the meat. So next generation credential is not a feature name. It's an internal working name that we're using so that I can talk intelligently about this capability that we're delivering. We're working on branding this, and we'll come up with a great name that meets all the trademark requirements. But for now, we'll refer to it as NGC, and later on in the product cycle will change. And so to you as IT folks, this is going to look very, very familiar. This is not like some radical shift in, it's like the PKI next generation with something that you have to completely wrap your head around. This is something that you can put in place because it's so similar to what you have today. It's just some additional technology on top of what you already have. So this identity can be a certificate or it can be something that is a little different, which is a key pair. So we have this notion of key-based authentication, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that so that'll make sense. But it should look familiar. To your end users, it's going to be familiar too. It's going to be a PIN, which maybe is familiar to them. It's not a password. Technically, a PIN is very similar to a password. It could be alpha or numeric characters. It can be a lot of different things. What makes this better than a password is there's always a second factor behind it, right? It's not just a PIN. It's a PIN plus something else, something that you're going to have, and we'll talk more about that. But anyway, you can use biometrics or PIN. PIN is the less optimal scenario, but it's the one that people will be using most frequently. We're working very hard with OEMs to make sure that biometric options are in every device. We don't have any announcements, but I'm expecting later this year you're going to see OEMs talk about biometrics a lot. They are working very quickly to make sure that they have sensors. We talked about this last year. We thought that we'd have touch sensors for fingerprints and devices in 2014. It may still happen, maybe towards the end of the year, but I think it really is going to be something we see into next year. So it's coming a little later than we wanted. If you want to know why it's late, it actually has to do with hardware, not so much the software. The hardware was still too expensive, and so we've worked with OEMs to solve that. So biometrics will go mainstream pretty quickly. When it comes to identity providers validating the user, so if I'm going to move to a certificate-based system or a key-based system, well, how do I prove my identity when I got a brand new device? I walk to a new device, I need to tell AD who I am. And so your way of bootstrapping access to this new credential type is through OTP or a one-time code or phone factor. So imagine getting to a device, entering in your username, and then being given OTP password to sign in, and then it creates this new credential type, and then you're able to use that moving forward. So we still need to rely on something similar to a password, in this case something that's one time, to bootstrap the process of getting this new credential type. And then we'll talk more about this last bullet when I come to a different slide because it's a little easier to talk to you there. So when it comes to this new credential type, how is it going to be stored or secured? And so this credential will go inside a container, and we have a slide that kind of talks more about that. But this container is a secure location in Windows. Access to the credential is gated by the user's PIN or the biometric identity, and the credential itself and the container are protected by the TPM. So this container, while maybe physically removable from the PC, would always remain in an encrypted state. It can only be accessed on the PC where the container was created. So the TPM is what secures it by binding it to the device. Now, if you're worried about TPM prevalence in your organization still, I think the word today is, well, almost every commercial device for the last couple years has a TPM. So our view is if you have TPM-less devices, meaning devices with no TPM, those should be on the way of aging out. Because I can't name a business class PC that doesn't have a TPM in the last couple years. Maybe in certain regions there are, maybe in China and Russia. There have been some TPM challenges there, but those have been mostly worked out, by the way. You can today buy a Lenovo PC with a TPM that is supported. There are organizations that, through their legal counsel, are able to get the ability to bring in devices with TPM into those regions. And so the issue a couple years ago where you couldn't use TPM in those regions has really pretty much gone away. We're not providing legal guidance here today. Go talk to your own legal counsel to determine whether you can use those devices safely. Obviously, if you buy a Lenovo in China, you can use it in China because it's already been sanctioned. But be very careful about this because we're not attorneys here, and we don't want anybody in trouble. So we use the TPM to protect it. Oh, and one last thing on TPM as well. In 2015, a rule will be in place where every new Windows PC has to have a TPM, not just in business class, but also in consumer. So even the lowest end consumer device will have one. And there's a number of ways we're going to get there. TPM doesn't have to be discrete anymore. It used to be a physical chip. With Windows 8, we have a firmware-based TPM. So if the device is a Atom processor or it's a ARM processor, both of those have a security component. On ARM, it's called Trust Zone. On Intel, it's called Platform Trust Technology. I can put firmware TPM in that security component, and it's just as good as a discrete component. But it's firmware-based. So this reduces the cost, right? It's firmware. So now it's free. It's part of this chip, basically, by default. And so that lowers the cost. And so this is one way it's going to trickle down into consumer. In fact, I think every tablet today has it. In fact, anything that's running Atom or ARM has TPM already. And every Windows phone, because it's running ARM, has TPM already. So we're already getting pretty close to pervasive, but not on the low end on the consumer side. But that changes in 2015. Let me make sure that I think I covered all this. So let's move on. So I keep on mentioning this word familiar. So in order for this to be acceptable organization, it can't be too radically different. So I just want to establish the point that this should feel familiar. So if you're an organization that's deployed PKI, you can continue to use PKI with Next Generation Credential. You don't have to throw that out. Next Generation Credential is something sitting on top of it. In fact, you can think of Next Generation Credential as the means to get access to the certificate that you're provisioning to the device. So in the case of acquiring this certificate, of course, the user has to prove their identity, and then they enroll their device, and they maybe through management or through some other practices, they end up receiving this certificate, and now they have that on their device. So that part should look just the same. So what looks a little different is how do you get access to the credential, right? The PC is bound to the device, but how does Windows Sign In interact with it? Well, that's where Next Generation Credential comes in. Next Generation Credential is sitting on top of the certificate and using an unlock gesture, as we call it, using the PIN or the biometric access. That's what unlocks the container, allows the TPM to decrypt it, and now you have access to the certificate, and you can use it for authentication. From here, everything is the same. None of your infrastructure needs to change. Once I unlock and I get access to the certificate, I can use it for authentication, and I can say, hey, I need a token, authenticate me. AD will say, hey, I trust you because you've been authenticated, here's your token, and now I can get access to network resources. So this works pretty much the same way as it's done before. The only thing that's really new is number one, how do I get access to this thing? It used to be I have a password on the system, and I've got a certificate underneath it, and I trust this device because of it. Now, the gesture, the PIN, or the biometric gesture unlocks a container that has a certificate, and I can use that for authentication into the device itself. So I can do it without a password, in other words. All right. So let's talk about the new approach. So PKI is one option, but I talk to a lot of organizations, even very large ones, that are not using PKI. And sometimes I'm surprised by this, but at the same time, it's not surprising, right? PKI is a difficult task, right? If you've deployed it yourself, you know that requires a lot of expertise, a lot of infrastructure, generates support calls, and there's just a lot of complexity with it. So with this key-based approach, we have a slightly different mode. So let's imagine that I'm an existing user, and I've just got a brand new device, and I've unboxed it, and I want to be able to sign into this device using this new credential type. Well, there's a couple of options. Option one is I'm going to take this device and I'm going to make that a trusted device by enrolling it into the system. So what I need to do first is I need to prove my identity. So I need to go up to Active Directory and say, hey, I'm Chris Hallam. I need to authenticate. I want to create a new trusted device. And I'll need a one-time code, maybe phone factor or OTP, whatever, to establish, to create that trust connection. Or I could even use a smart card. So in fact, at Microsoft, this is probably what we'll do. We're already using smart cards. Bootstrapping the trust process will probably be done by saying, hey, I have a smart card, you trust this, create this new credential type on the device that I want to sign into. So I prove my identity. Once I've done that, the PC will then generate the key pair. So these keys, a public and a private key, will be generated locally through Windows using the TPM in part if the TPM is present. And we'll create this key pair, and the public key will then be sent up to Active Directory or the IDP, whoever it is. It'll be mapped to my account, and now it knows who I am. And so next time I want to sign in, I can get authenticated, I can sign something using my private key, I can send it to the server says, I've got your public key, everything's good to go and matches, I'm going to give you an access token, and now you can access all the resources that you're entitled to. So this is a familiar approach for the most part, but it's a little bit different in the middle here, right? We have the unlock mechanism, it gives us access to the keys, we got the key creation part, the keys are being created locally, they're not being given to me by infrastructure, and then the key needs to be sent from the PC to Active Directory as opposed to the PKI scenario where it's already there. Okay, so let's talk about how we secure these keys. So these are not the prettiest diagrams, but I think they're good enough to make the point. So there are two containers the next generation credentials supports. Futuristically, maybe there could be more, but today we're supporting what we call the default container. And this is where your consumer next generation credentials will go, right? An organization, though, may want their credentials to go into a separate container, and I'll explain why in a moment. But inside those containers will be, let's start with on the left hand, your left, is your consumer accounts will be there. So my MSA account will be there, my LinkedIn in Next Generation could be there. Any sort of credentials from IDPs or websites could be there. So that's one container. And the other container might be the enterprise container where my Microsoft credential is placed. And so why do I want it in a separate container? Well, it makes it easy for the enterprise to wipe their stuff without worrying about the other things. So that's more ease of use for, I guess, for us. But the real scenario is, you know what? Some websites will choose to have a unlock gesture of 4-digit PIN. Maybe that's good enough for getting access to my MSA account or my LinkedIn account. It just needs to be 4 digits. But maybe Microsoft wants it to be much better. Maybe it should be 8 digits. And maybe it should even include alphanumeric characters. So for this reason, because when I have a single unlock gesture that unlocks the entire container, if we don't have same rules on pin length or complexity, if you want to call it that, then obviously we need a separate container. And so the experience that you would have is when you sign into a PC, if let's say MSA, you're using a 4-digit code, is I would sign in, I would get access to all the credentials, and I'd get single sign-in with all of those. So if I went to LinkedIn from here, it would never ask who I am. If I go to Microsoft service, it would never ask who I am, because when I sign into Windows, I'm effectively signing into everything. But then when I needed to access a corporate credential, Windows will then give you a prompt saying, hey, I need you to provide your corporate credential and your 8-digit PIN or whatever it happens to be. And so that's why we have the two containers. Part of it's because of wiping. Part of it is because different enterprises will have different PIN requirements. Now, when it comes to biometrics, obviously it's not relevant. Biometrics is, I don't think you can get... It's kind of a binary thing, right? There's no concept of biometric complexity or length, obviously. All right. So what will happen, of course, is the keys themselves will be encrypted. So the container is a software thing, but the keys within them are protected by the TPM itself. So that's the first thing that we use the TPM for. And then the user has a user unlock gesture, which uses this thing that we call the Next Generation Credential Service, which if you're using Technical Preview, you can find this service. We won't be able to do much with it because it's all plumbing and API stuff really for ourselves at this point. So you really can't test this. But there is a service that does the brokering. And once you use the unlock gesture, the next generation service uses the TPM saying, hey, I'm authorized to decrypt these keys that you're protecting, decrypt them and make them available so that I can use them to sign into the device and other resources on the web. So it's a pretty simple process. In the event that a TPM is not present, you can still use Next Generation Credential, but obviously I can't give you this high-level assurance on protection. I can't give you a theft-proof assurance if I can't bind it to the PC, because the best we can do is store it inside of software. So let's talk a little bit more about the unlock gesture. We have PINs, and we've got biometrics, and so let's drill a little bit more on that. So in the case of PIN, the PIN can use uppercase, lowercase, symbols, white space, anything, any character you want to use, you can use for a PIN. So it's not just numeric, so you can use policy that we'll make available to you to decide how complex that needs to be for your organization. So, and then, of course, you can also use length. So we have 4 to 20 digits. And so you can choose what's right for you. At Microsoft, we're using 8 digits, and I think that's a pretty good way to go because 8 digits is a big number, and maybe more important than the sheer volume of numbers when it comes to brute force protection, the TPM will lock the device and prevent you from signing in if you try to brute force your way into one of these pins, for example. So a couple years ago with TPM 1.2, if you're familiar with TPM, TPM lockout policy was up to the TPM vendor to create. So that meant that some people would say after 4 tries on your pin, we're going to lock down the PC. Some people it was 20. The way those failed attempts age out over time was not standardized. So it was really random. In fact, a lot of people really ran into issues, particularly on some Lenovo devices. Those failed attempts wouldn't age out for a really long time. So if you use the wrong pin for your BitLocker unlock code, maybe 7 or more times in the course of a week, you'd be locked out of your device and calling support. So we worked with the TCG, the Trusted Computing Group, which owns the TPM specification. We're a board member there, and so we work on it with them. And we came up with a standardization that was implemented with TPM 2.0. The brute force protection loosely works like this. 32 failed attempts. Sounds like a big number, is the number that we use. We've done a lot of research, and the TCG did a lot of research to find out, well, what do people do? Well, they tend to type in their password a lot of times when they fail, up to 32 times. And we figured 32 is a safe bet. We also think 32 failed attempts on a number that's 8 digits, the chances of you getting the right one are pretty low. The age out, 1 an hour. And so it resets itself. And every TPM 2.0 or greater is based on that policy. So we won't run into random TPM lockouts like we experience when you're moving to a TPM 2.0 world or greater. And as I mentioned, you can have separate pins for the containers, but hopefully you're using biometrics so you don't have to deal with any of this this type of stuff. So let's switch gears and let's talk about biometrics. And let me do a quick time check. Okay, so we got good time. All right. So when it comes to biometrics, there's a lot of different technology choices. These are the types of technologies. There's optical and thermal and ultrasound. The technology that's winning in the marketplace is called a capacitive sensor. Many of you already know what this is. And you've probably got some questions and doubts about it because you've probably seen a lot of news or heard about spoofing fingerprint sensors, etc. And so here's just kind of an interesting story. There's a couple years ago in Brazil, there's a hospital, and the doctors, when they check in for work for their shift, they use their biometric identity to say, I'm here. So they sign in, and then they sign out. So they know when doctors are coming and going. And these sensors are using optical technology, which is nothing more than a photocopier or a scanner type of thing. So it's got really nothing more than a camera imagery in it. And so what they decided, they're like, hey, why don't we... you know, things are pretty slow in the hospital during a lot of days. Why don't we maybe go to the bar or go to the football game, and a few of you can sign us in for us. And so they built these rubber fingers that look just like that. And so you can see them there. There's the list of them for each of the doctors who are implicated. And so they would just sign each other in, and some of them would be on shift, and some of them wouldn't, and everybody's covered, and everybody was pretty happy except the employer and the patients who didn't get the services they needed. But at any rate, these were based on optical sensors. And so these rubber finger things, those don't really work on modern sensors, capacitive sensors. And so what we consider capacitive sensors or modern sensors, they have two attributes. But they don't have to have both. The first one is really kind of optional. They should be touch-based. So if you have an iPhone 5S or greater, you're familiar with the touch sensor. It's just something you touch and then you sign in. Great. Right, it's a great sensor, really convenient, right? And that's what you'll be seeing on Windows PCs shortly. But the thing that's more important than touch is aliveness detection, right? That's not alive, right? That's dead, that's plastic or rubber or silicone, right? So a sensor needs to have the ability to differentiate between different materials. It should have the ability to differentiate between human flesh, live flesh even, and something that's dead, not living. Now, you have sensors probably on your devices already. How many people use Lenovo devices here, just out of curiosity? So we got a lot of Lenovo users. I have a Lenovo X1 Carbon, and I love it. And it has a swipe sensor. So it's not touch, but it is swipe. But it does have all the attributes from a security perspective that we think make it a great choice for security. and biometrics. So if you're not using that sensor today, which is the case in most cases, I recommend you give it a try. And you can do that very easily if you're using Windows 8.1, because Windows 8.1 has all of the middleware. Everything you need is in the box. Windows 7 does not have the middleware. You need to go to Lenovo for not just the driver, but all the middleware to make that sensor work. But with Windows 8, we built all the technology. Everything you need is now in Windows. All we need is a driver for the sensor. So we really committed ourselves to fingerprints, although we endorse anything out there in the world that makes sense. We have a biometrics framework that will work for facial and iris and palm and all the other variations out there. We support those, but we're indexing and optimizing for the other. Now, when I talked about liveness detection, this is a fingerprint from a cadaver. This is somebody who's not living anymore. This is their fingerprint, and you'll see that it looks fairly flat. And that's because we don't have all the moisture that we have when we're alive. And this is what a fingerprint looks like in somebody who's living right now. You don't get the same imprint, right? So these different things look very different to the sensors. These sensors are very very sensitive. In fact, many of the sensors, those from FPC, if you're familiar with FPC, they look at 3D image of your fingerprint. So it's not just the print itself, the peak, but it's also the valley, and as well as the data in between. And they get a very detailed 3D representation of your fingerprint. So they can do very, very good biometric analysis on your finger. Now, we click again. There we go. This is an FPC sensor. Now, this is just an example. That could be placed on top of the palm rest of a laptop as an example. We've worked with them to encourage the OEMs to not put the chrome around it. Let's just embed it in the device where it looks as if it's part of the device. And I've seen some great samples. I have one in my bag even, where you can see that it's just flush on the device, and similar to what you'd have on the iPhone today. But the point is the middle is you know, it's this touch-based surface, and they can be different sizes. And that's actually something that's worth talking about. FPC and others, the Validity and others, they believe that the optimal sensor size is about 9 millimeters by 9 millimeters. When you do that, I get a larger imprint of my finger. When I shrink it down, I'm getting less information. And that means that it may still be secure, but less information maybe theoretically means less security in my view, right? The more information about my finger, the more authentic I might feel that it is. And so 9x9 is a good sensor, but the problem is that sensor's too expensive. It's about maybe $5, $10 per sensor, and imagine putting that on a $200 device with 1% margin or less, right? Or negative margin, right? We have a lot of devices at that price point negative. It's never going to make it. So what we've worked on is coming up with something that's smaller, and so we're still working on the exact length. The downside of that is when you enroll your fingerprint, much like the iPhone, you'll have to touch it several times because it needs to get a broader area, right? With this large 9x9, I can get my entire print with one try. With a smaller surface, I need to give it more information, and that's why the iPhone asks you to do it again and again and again and again, and eventually it compiles your entire fingerprint by you typing in enough times, so or putting it in enough times. So that's kind of how the sensors work, but we're going to get the cost down where these can go mainstream, and we have an OEM signaling, not committing, but signaling that they may put it across all of their consumer devices and commercial devices in the near future. So this is pretty imminent, and I hope that I don't get burned again on this, because we talked about this last year, but there's a lot of work on getting the sensor costs down. So how secure are the sensors? Well, there's been a lot of discussion about this. Here's an example of the iTouch sensor being hacked. That happened within 24 hours, and then there's the Samsung one that got hacked within 24 hours. And so a lot of people are like, I can't trust this. This is not acceptable. So to tee up the story and to have a little bit of fun, because I think we should have fun at a 5 o'clock session, let's show you this quick video with this very famous man who I find
now on Friday we awesome told you about to. The competitions and the race to hack the iPhone 5S fingerprint scanner. One group claims to have done exactly this using everyday means. The Chaos Computer Club from Germany demonstrated their technique in a video posted online today. Samuel Burke is in the study with me now to show us how they alleged it. Now, Apple said that the fingerprint was the new ultra uber secure, and everybody wants to break it. Have they managed it?
Well, it appears that the Computer Chaos Club has done it, and they say it's very easy. They've even posted a manual on their website. And in fact, you just had your thumb right there on the glass, so we could start there.
So they've already put it online?
It's online on their website, and they have a little guide, and they say it's very easy. So they say, first, you just have to get a thumbprint from somewhere, a doorknob, a piece of glass. So I saw you just had your thumb there, so I come in with a camera, I take a picture of your thumbnail, then with some special toner, some special ink, you print it with one of these onto a piece of transparent paper. You print the thumbnail, exactly, the thumbprint. Then you just take glue. It says you can even use household glue. Put it over that thumbprint where we've printed. There's Richard Quest thumbprint. Put glue there. Then you just come on, you go like this. Put a piece of transparent paper there. And then you let it stay for a while, go like this. And then you can just go like this onto the phone, and you can get into the iPhone. And they even posted a video on YouTube that shows how you can do it. Very simple, according to them. If you take a look at this piece of video right there, Richard, there you go. You see the person putting their thumb. They've done exactly what I just laid out, like the instructions there on their website. They go onto the iPhone, put it right there, that piece of plastic, and they're into the iPhone. It seems very simple on the website, but
right.
I spoke...
Now, hang on. Let's take this bit by bit. So, according to that demo, all you need is your thumbprint or your fingerprint,
yep,
a bit of plastic, some toner cartridge,
exactly,
take a picture, a bit of glue, the right glue,
exactly,
and it works. But you're telling me it's not as easy.
No, I spoke to some experts today, and they say the guy who did this from the Computer Chaos Club is one of the best, if not the best, in the world at duplicating thumbprints. He has lots of expertise, lots of experience, and yes, he laid out some of these materials, but he knows how to do it. And for instance, when you take the picture of the thumbprint, you have to know exactly how to print it on this piece of
laminate. But they did it!
He did it! He's the
they
best!
They did it!
He's the
no,
best!
No, come on, if they did it, others can do it!
Yes, possibly others could do it, but they say they'd have to be experts, that it can't just be done with these in your house. You have to know exactly how to do it.
You're being cynical.
Well, I'm telling you what the experts told me.
Anyway, I'll stop it there. I didn't time that thing in the upper left. I thought that was funny. So anyway, I thought I'd inject a little humor in there because it's late. And let me go back to the presentation. So I think the takeaway, other than having a little bit of a laugh, I find that guy really funny, is this hack is really not something that's being weaponized and used. And the reason why we know this is true is there's a video from the Chaos Club, and there's a whole bunch of press about it. I haven't seen anybody actually. Where's the YouTube video with kids doing using these techniques? There's nothing on YouTube. I haven't seen one. Not that there isn't. But this is not a trivial attack. This requires a high level of expertise, and this is not something that that I'm lying awake at night worrying about. So I still believe in the iPhone 5S's sensor. Maybe you expected me to throw Apple under the bus because I was showing all this. But no, I think that their sensor is fine. I think the Galaxy 5 sensor is fine. The attack that we need to worry about is not somebody taking their own fingerprint and recreating it and breaking into their own device. What we need to worry about is a latent print sitting on a beer mug or on a glass table that I left, and then somebody needs to get that, and then they need to go steal my device, right? So there's a bunch of things that need to happen in order for this to work. And so in some respects, we could argue very easily that passwords are way worse, right? I got one organization that's got 1.2 billion username and password combinations, and they can use my account from anywhere in the world for the most part, right? With this, they need to steal my device, they need to recreate my print, and chances are that maybe they can't get that done right. So I'm not saying that these are bulletproof sensors, but they, I think, are better than some of the things that we're using today. So yes, they're safe in our view. All right, so let's talk about protecting these keys. And so we talked a little bit about it. So the TPM is going to protect these keys. But there's a risk that these keys could be recreated, right? So in theory, we have algorithms that should prevent key pairs from ever being recreated. But guess what, right? We all know what happened with MD5, right? MD5 is no longer good because why? Because collision attacks are used to manipulate it and circumvent its security benefits, basically. And so what we want to do is a couple things. Is we want to protect, use the TPM to bind it to the device, but we also want Two other things. We want to make sure that we can prove that the key that you're using right now for authentication, that this private key, this thing that I've signed saying, hey, here I'm me, that signature was created by the same TPM that created the public key. So we have this notion of TPM attestation. So we actually have the ability, using TPM attestation, to determine not just that the key pair matches, that it was generated from the same TPM. So this is an important part of security, because what will happen one day is whatever algorithms we use, somebody will eventually find a way to circumvent them. So this gives us a backstop, something that we can say, hey, we know that at least, yes, the signatures look the same, or they match, but we know the TPM was different. Something else created this signature that we're trying to use. The other thing is TPM proofing or trustworthiness. There's a lot of fear that as we put more and more of our trust in the TPM, well, what happens if somebody builds bogus TPMs and puts them in PCs, right? I mean, how do I prevent somebody from bringing a white box? I don't know if you use white box terminology here, but meaning a device that I don't go to an OEM to. I go to a small shop and I buy a motherboard and a video card and I piece together this thing. So I get this motherboard from China or whatever. You know, how do I know that's a trustworthy TPM? Well, we need the ability to establish that. So inside the TPM is something that we call the EK. Right? So this is this root key. It's a unique key for the TPM, and it chains up to a certificate authority for the manufacturer. And so Microsoft would be providing a whitelisting service of trustworthy TPMs. So you'll be able to subscribe to this service and use TPM attestation saying, hey, I trust keys if the TPM was the one that generated them, and the TPM itself is a trustworthy TPM, something that I can trust. So we'll have a service in the cloud that allows you to facilitate this round-trip transaction. Now, some of you will want this to be on-premise. You don't want to depend on a cloud service. We were talking about a means to put that in a federated scenario where you can put up this service, get the information from us on what we consider trustworthy TPMs, and you can include the list as it is, or you can say, no, we only trust TPMs from Infineon or whatever. So you can make some choices there, but we'll give you what we think is a good whitelist or allow list of TPMs. And so I think with these two features, I think we can establish even more trust in the TPM than we have today. Because I think as we make it harder to hack on Windows, I think we're going to see more hardware level attacks than we've seen in the past, right? We've kind of got rid of firmware attacks because of UEFI, but I think people are going to start trying other things. So this will help us there. So let's talk about kind of how the validation process works. And so this is a slide from engineering. It's kind of complicated. I wish I could have simplified it. But basically, what we're trying to talk about here is what we call is an IDP direct scenario. And so what does IDP direct mean? Well, this is a scenario that is most likely going to occur with a bank, right? And so let me explain why. So when I go to the bank today, they've given me a username and password, and so they are the IDP. They authenticate me, and they own that whole relationship end to end. In a relying party model, right, is a model where a website that I'm accessing relies on somebody else to authenticate me. So Facebook is used as an IDP, and I can sign into all sorts of websites around the world using my Facebook credentials, which is great because I don't need to create a special account on that, and Facebook owns the relationship there. So we call the first scenario here IDP direct, meaning that the website I'm going to is going to authenticate me, and the relying party model is the one where I'll go to a website and they will rely on somebody else to authenticate me, maybe Facebook or maybe a Microsoft account, or everybody wants to be an IDP these days, so it'll be a number of other people. The point we're trying to make in this slide is in the IDP direct scenario, if I create an account, let's say on, trying to think of a European bank, let's say Barclays Bank. Let's say I want to create a brand new account on Barclays, and they're supporting our new next generation credential. When I create my account and say who I am, and I give them all my information, they're going to send a request down to the client saying, okay, great, since you have Windows 10, let's use this next generation credential, generate a key pair and give me your public key, and I'll send that public key up to them. And so we call that the IDP direct scenario. You authenticate your own users, you own the authentication. The next scenario is the relying party scenario. And so what we have here, and it's kind of a complex thing, so I'm going to send from the monitor here, is it's very similar to what we had before, except there's one thing in the middle you'll see, which is something called the token broker. And then on the left, we have the relying party. So let's imagine I'm logging onto the relying party. Let's say it's that local flower shop that I talked about earlier. So, and let's say that they support logging in with Facebook or Microsoft account or all the other people who want to be an IDP. They as a relying party will say, hey, I want you to perform authentication. Yeah, give me your something that's signed so we can check you out. And so what will happen is that transaction comes down to the token broker. And the token broker will say, oh, okay, I see that you're requesting Facebook credentials or you're requesting a Microsoft private key. So the broker then will fetch it and create, get the signed bits. If it needs to get authenticated, it will get the access token, et cetera, and then the broker then performs the authentication. So we have this thing in the middle that enables the website to say, hey, which IDP should be authenticating me? The token broker then gets access to the right key pair or the private key and then signs something and sends it up to the IDP, who then sends down an access token that then allows the user to get access. So I hope that kind of made sense. Probably makes sense more on the slides than the way I explained it, maybe. But I think it is pretty straightforward. So we support both scenarios, and this token broker is a pretty interesting feature, obviously. So there's this philosophical debate that comes up every time I talk about virtual smart cards. So if you remember Windows 8 and 8.1, we had virtual smart cards. Well, this feels a lot like a virtual smart card, doesn't it, right? The big difference is that I can use biometrics on top of my virtual smart card, right? Whereas before it was just a PIN. And so the question of it being two-factor or not comes up quite often. And the philosophical debate is about if my second factor is the device I'm signing into, is it truly two-factor? Who thinks it's two-factor? The minority. I agree with you, by the way. By definition, it's two-factor. Do I get stronger security if I have my credential on a mobile phone or something else? I would say yes, because now I have my phone or my smart card. I've got a PC I need to target, which is something else, and I need something I know or something that I am. So I think it's more secure, but it is true two-factor. And NGC can be either one, right? So if I want to bring my phone, and that can be my true two-factor option, we have that option. If you want to enroll PCs and make them the second factor, you can make that choice as well. So we support all of the options, whereas with a virtual smart card, we didn't have that option. Your PC had to be the second factor, and that raised a lot of concerns with some people, and so with Next Generation Credential, we support it any way you want it. Now, our APIs, in theory, allow devices other than phones to be the second factor, so we'll see what the IHVs do out there, but in theory, it could be something other than my phone. But we don't have any announcements on that other than the fact that we have APIs that support it. All right, so let me boot my phone up here, and then let's do just a quick demo. How many people were at the keynote with Joe Belfiore and saw the demo of Next Generation Credential? Okay, so that's not quite half. So some of you have seen this. I actually didn't see how Joe demoed it, I'll do the best I can to do it the way I would assume that he would have. So let me switch to my other device here. All right, so there we are. All right, so as I talked about earlier, the phone, and I didn't talk about this in much depth actually, is that the PC can be my second factor, or I can enroll my phone. And when I enroll my phone, I can walk up to any PC and I have my mobile credential. Now, one thing that's really great about that is I can walk up to a kiosk and I can use this as a kiosk, which is something that I do not trust. And guess what? The kiosk doesn't have my credential. It just has the ability to communicate with this device. Today, when you go to a kiosk, what do? You sign in with your username and password. That thing's got a keylogger on it. It's game over for your account, right? So it's pretty scary walking up to these devices. But when we have a next generation credential, I have this higher level of assurance. So with the phone, what I can do is I can go ahead and sign in. Sadly, I can't show you both at once, but so you'll have to believe me here. But let me go in and sign in. So I've got my phone. So many of you can see I'm signed in. And so I've got my Windows desktop here. And I'm going to go ahead and press the button to sign in. And the phone is saying, okay, please type in your PIN. So I'm going to go ahead and type my PIN. It's a really secure PIN for a test device. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And then you'll see that I've signed in very quickly. Now, this is one way of doing it. This is not the way I'm going to do it when I ship. This will be an option, but the real way you want to do it is you want to put this phone in your pocket, you want to walk in proximity of your device, and you want to input your PIN here. And so that's something we can't show you today, but that's something that we ship. So that obviously is the experience that you want. You don't want to have to pull your phone out of your case or your bag or your pocket to sign into the device. So, and there's other things we can do to make it even more convenient. But that, I think, is a pretty good way. Now, incidentally, wouldn't it be cool if I could use biometrics to use the biometric sensor on my laptop and it unlocks the credential that's here, and then I'm able to do transaction that way? I'm sad to announce that that's technically a very difficult challenge, and the reason why is the biometric data is on your phone, on your PC, would be different than the biometric data on your phone, which may have a different sensor and different algorithms to store the templates, and so that's a problem we're looking on, like, how do we solve? So PIN is really the scenario you'll be using in the short term, but I think long term we can solve that problem. All right, so back end. What do I need on the back end to make this thing go? Well, it's going to be pretty easy. If this technology is hard to deploy, it won't get deployed. It's built in Azure Active Directory. It's built in MSA. So when you get your brand new consumer PC and you sign with MSA, we're going to generate next generation credential for you. It's all going to happen behind the scenes. You're good to go, two-factor auth right away. So that's great for consumers. If you're Azure Active Directory, we can do the same thing. Active Directory, a little bit different. You're going to have to deploy at a Windows 10 aligned server instance, and I call it Windows 10 aligned because we haven't come up with a name for the next version of Windows Server. But the next version of Windows Server, which aligns with 10, you'll need to deploy at least 180 server role out there alongside your existing infrastructure. And that depends on your topology. If you have multiple forests, then it's going to be more, right? And if you have complex topologies, then you may need more than one. But I think a lot of the organizations I'm talking to, our goal is that you could get that one server out there and you can make this work right away. And I underlined our goal because we're still working at engineering level on how we make this actually work. And so in the end, it may require more than one. But that's something that we want to do because we want this to be super easy to get into your environment. And so, as I mentioned there at the bottom, we're still... Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to switch back to the slides. Sorry. So this slide says pretty much already everything I just said. So the last point there was the plans for on-premise still under development, but I think we're gonna get. I think we'll meet our goal, but we'll see. All right. So for user proofing, so if I'm walking up to a brand new device, how do I establish trust? Well, you could use your existing password you have. And then once you use it, then we can generate a next generation credential, and then your organization can roll you off of passwords so you can't use them anymore is one option. You can use OTP, you can use a code, you can use an existing two-factor authentication option. That's what we did at Microsoft to enroll in a virtual smart card. We actually used our physical smart card as a way to prove our identity so that then we could establish trust and then generate a virtual smart card. And something I forgot to mention on the slide was phone factor. All right, so what devices does this work on? This will be supported on any Windows 7 device as long as it's running Windows 10. So if you have Windows 7 hardware and you want to put Windows 10 on it, you can use NGC. It's not dependent on TPN, but a whole lot better when it's there. So this will work on basically anything that you have in your environment. We've already talked about the middle bucket there, about support for AD Azure Active Directory and Microsoft accounts. And then we're evangelizing this technology to see if we can get the web to adopt this technology as well. At launch, you're going to be able to use Next Generation Credential across a huge range of business services that you're using. So if you want to use the business version of Box, which supports Azure Active Directory sign-in, guess what? You can use your two-factor authentication option to that service with this, right? You don't have to use phone factor, right, which is kind of lame, to be quite honest, right? Compared to this, at least. It's better than nothing, but it doesn't give you the usability. So these are just a couple of examples here. I want to be really clear with Facebook and Google. These are their business services. This is not login to Facebook. Now, that could happen, but these are things that we'll be able to deliver right at launch, right? All that stuff that Azure Active Directory supports today, we support that too right away. This is not for the consumer side of these businesses. They need to do some work with the token broker that we talked about earlier to enable them to make this work for themselves. So another thing that's going to make this thing work really well is this is not a Microsoft proprietary solution. This is based on the work of the FIDO Alliance, the FAFSA Identity Online Alliance. So I think if you go to FIDO.org, you'll be able to learn more about that. Here's a statement from the president of the group, basically saying that, hey, passwords are going away in a hurry, and he's definitely right about that. Who's on the board at FIDO? Why is this standards group matter? Well, it matters because there's some really great companies involved in it, and one of them might be surprising to you. One is us, another is Google. So Microsoft and Google are working together, both as board members, to make sure that we have a common specification and that the implementations of our solutions can interoperate. Because if Google has a solution that doesn't work and interoperate with Windows infrastructure, then we haven't succeeded. This has to be one way of authenticating that works for the world, one that works for consumers, one that works for enterprises. Google announced last week their secure key feature, which is a kind of a dongle-based USB key. You plug it in and you authenticate with that. Same type of concept as what we're working on. I think something that's a differentiator for us is you're going to be able to use your existing devices as a second factor. You don't need to buy another product to do this. You can use your PC or your phone. And I don't believe that I mentioned that it isn't just your Windows phone. It can be your iOS phone. It can be your Android phone as well. So we're not limiting it just to Windows phones. So you buy Windows phones. We'd love you to do that. But it will work on all the phones that you probably have in your pockets. We don't have any announcements on BlackBerry at this point. But of course, we're taking feedback. Coincidentally, BlackBerry is on the board, but we don't have an NGC support story for that device at this point. So this is going to succeed. Another thing too is you look at the bottom there, you see a lot of consumer companies like Netflix. This just tells you how important I think two-factor auth is for especially content providers like Netflix, banking, PayPal, etc. So you'll see we have platform people, we have payment systems. Consumers, technology, content providers, etc. So let me show you, we're getting pretty close to wrapping up here. I'm running actually a little long, so I'm going to move through this pretty quickly. Here's what the out-of-box experience will look like. Let's imagine I go to your retail shop, I brand a new PC. Again, these are not final UI, these are just to give you an idea of what the experience would be like. I unbox a PC, I turn it on, I hit the continue button, and then I have an option to sign in with my username or password. One thing you're going to have to do is you're going to have to differentiate. Is this a consumer device for myself, or is this a business device? And you need to choose this fork in the road because this gives Windows a lot of information on what type of account to create you, where to put like that next generation credential, which container, et cetera. So you'll choose a fork. In this case, it's going to be, hey, this is a corporate device. I'll enter in my username. I hit go. In this case, the organization says, hey, we're going to send you a one-time code to your phone. Use that to sign in. Once we sign in, I'm generating the next generation credential key pair. I'm setting up the public key to my Azure Active Directory infrastructure here. I see some smiles, so, oh, yeah, that is funny, isn't it? I've never read that. But anyway, public key's up there, mapped to my account. And something else that's maybe just as important, I'm actually enrolling you in your MDM. So you don't have to go do that as a second step. Once I know your username in Azure Active Directory, I know who your MDM is too. I'm enrolling you in that. I'm pushing apps to you in the background while you're providing your proofing mechanism, which in this case is a biometric option. So I'm going to touch my sensor a couple times. Oops, I skipped. And now I have a fully loaded device. I'm logging in using Azure Active Directory. I've got my apps from my MDM. I've got my policy. I got my email coming down. I mean, this is the experience that we've always wanted, right? And if you're using OneDrive for business or Box, that data's coming down. I have my corporate data. I mean, this is like the throwaway PC world, right? Where if this PC gets broken, I just get a new one, plug it in, I got everything I need. We're finally really getting there. With less work for you. You could always get there with your own infrastructure, but now most of it's provided for you in the cloud. So let's switch gears and talk about pass the hash. So I think I teed up what pass the hash was, so I'm not going to go into a lot more detail, but just a quick recap. For those that were sleeping, when I authenticate, I get an access token. Attackers are stealing these tokens, and when they have them, they can be you on the network without your username and password. And if it's an IT user's credential who has access to servers with administrative privileges, they can probably get the access tokens from their friends as well. So it's a very difficult attack to stop once it's started. And so with Windows 7 and 8, there we go. So you can see, as I get one token, I get more, and I get more, and I'm more. And as IT figures out, oh my gosh, Chris Hallam's access token is in use by an attacker, and they stop it, I've already got five other I can move over to, and I start using that one, and they stop that, and then I'm on to the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And we've had cases reported us where it took people like a year to get rid of an attacker using this type of attack. Now, there's tools out there that you can use to make it more easy to get rid of this, but it's still a difficult problem. So you understand what the attack is. So let's just jump to the last slide here and talk about the solution. So the solution that we have for pass the hash, we have a couple. One is on Windows 7, one's on Windows 8, and those are basically the same to the extent that they can. Those are just defenses. We just make it harder for bad guys to get tokens, right? They do not prevent, well, they prevent them, but sophisticated attackers can be able to bypass some of these mitigations, right? Especially with certain types of malware running with high privilege. So what we want to do in Windows 10 is eliminate the risk factor at all to the extent that we can. And so what we're doing is we're creating, we have a new technology called Virtual Secure Mode. Virtual Secure Mode is a mini operating system running min core Windows. So this is a tiny, tiny, tiny VM occupying almost no memory, right? Compared to a normal VM, which would be, you know, multiple gigabytes of memory being used for that VM. So this is a very tiny thing that will not impact the performance of your device. It's running on type of Hyper-V. So that means that it's running alongside of your main OS. Okay, that also means that it has its own kernel. And it means that the main OS does not have admin privileges to it, right? These are separate OSs running side by side. There is a constrained level of communication between these things. Not unfettered, meaning it has limited, very limited access on what it can do. The host OS, the kernel, the OS that you're running, has the ability to get access and tell the LSA, hey, do this. But it's not able to take the tokens out of the container. So the container is much like a sandbox. It keeps the data inside, more like a container is a better analogy. It keeps the data inside it, and it's running the LSA service inside of it. So this min core has one service running on it, plus all the access tokens, Kerberos tickets, and NTLM hashes are all sitting inside there. They cannot be pulled out by the design, unless there's some vulnerability that we aren't aware of. Architecturally, it should be impossible, but we can't promise that, of course. So this is a defective thing, right? So your tokens are in a lockbox. They can't escape. Now, this virtual secure mode has some benefits beyond just pass the hash. There's a feature that's related to malware resistance, which I'll mention very briefly. Today, our mobile phones are very secure from malware, at least if they're iOS and Windows phone devices, because all apps come through a store where there's vetting processes and there's a sandbox here, and it's very difficult to get malware on these type of devices. You have that on Windows Phone, you have that technology on Windows RT, you do not have that on desktop edition of Windows. With Windows Enterprise, we have a feature called Enterprise Lockdown. I know this is a little off topic on identity, but we have a few minutes, so I thought I'd mention it. And this is the last session for the day, so why not go long? But at any rate, you'll be able to lock down your Enterprise Edition devices just like your phones. It'll run any app from the store. It'll run any app from an ISV that is signed by our service. So we give ISVs a service that they can sign their binaries to. It's not just any signature. It's our signature, by the way, right? It's not just some VeriSign signature. And you as an organization can use the same sign service to sign your own line of business apps. Or you can sign ISV apps if your ISV won't sign them for you. So you can run any app, Win32, modern apps, doesn't matter. Any app that you can run on the desktop today, you can run on this. And the beauty is it only runs them if they're signed. So it's just like your phone, pretty much. There's a couple of exceptions. You know, on your phone, every app runs in a sandbox, and Win32 apps don't run in a sandbox. But you are going to be able to determine which apps run on your platform. And so we can drive malware. We can eliminate 99.9%+ of the malware we see in the ecosystem today with this feature alone. So these are going to be a very attractive offering. I'd recommend all you take a look at that in more detail, and we'll blog about it in more detail soon. But at any rate, the reason why I bring this up, it brings us back to VSM. So in order to make this feature reliable, right, well, what if a malware can get kernel access and can turn off this feature that locks down the PC? Well, that would be a big problem. So what we're doing is we're using VSM to run Hypervisor Code Integrity Service, now runs inside this special container, and now a compromised kernel can't turn off code integrity, which is really cool. And we also have the ability to put virtual TPM in a VSM as well. So today with VMs, you can't use TPM, right? Because there's a one-to-one relationship between a TPM and a physical instance of Windows. Well, with Windows 10 and Windows Server 10 aligned with Windows Server 10, you'll be able to run a virtual TPM running inside the VSM that's running alongside of your virtual machines. And so now you can take advantage of BitLocker, and you can take advantage of all the things we've talked about here. And so you can protect your identities using that. And so that is the last slide. I'm going to jump to the very end. So you, if you choose to, you can submit a review. Come on. There we go. So anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the session. And I'm pretty excited about this feature, if you can't tell. And so we have some time. We have 1 minute left on the clock for questions, but I'm going to stay here until you're done. Or until they kick me off. So to do questions, though, I want you to step up to the mic. Otherwise, the group won't be able to hear you, and it will be echoey. So if you don't mind standing up and going to the mic in the center of the room, that would be great. But some of you aren't moving, so I will I will force you.
I was waiting for you to pick us out. The PKI approach, where you use the PKI on your on-premises.
Yes.
Wouldn't that require you only using Kerberos applications and not NTLM because it requires Kerberos protocol transition?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? I'm sorry. I have a mic and I still can't hear you.
Would you be able to use NTLM applications
with
this approach or only Kerberos-enabled applications?
That's a good question. I'm trying to think why it wouldn't work for both. I didn't expect this question, so I'm wondering, is there something I'm not thinking through?
Because you're applying a certificate, and you need to convert that to an Active Directory account,
yeah,
and that is usually a Kerberos thing.
I don't think it's viable without it, but I'm going to have to go double check with the engineer to make sure I'm not wrong. So that's one I don't have an answer for at this moment. But
one more question.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Do you think you'll be implementing a policy that, for example, could prevent you from using your phone number as your PIN?
It would prevent you from using what?
Your phone number as your PIN code, because if you do that, there's not much security. You wouldn't need much brute forcing to find out.
I don't foresee us doing that, but maybe it's important. We don't have anything on the books on that. Okay. I could see why that might be desirable.
You could just look it up in AD. And so you can't use this?
I'll take that back to the engineering team. I haven't heard any discussion about PIN restrictions beyond length. So possibly you could mitigate that by having a 20-digit.